Hi, everyone. This is Kyler from Feeding Matters. Coming to you on August 22nd is the 2025 Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit. This year, we're going deeper. We're hearing from more professionals. In fact, we're going to hear from all four domains of PFD, as well as the two domains from ARFID. And we're going to look across lifespans, starting with neonatology and going all the way to adulthood. Most importantly, we're highlighting the lived experience. So if you want to come together with other professionals who are engaged and dedicated to serving families and children who struggle to eat while hearing from those families directly, this is your opportunity. We'll see you on August 22nd.
Presented by Feeding Matters with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Feeding Does Matter. I'm Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
Hi, and I'm Haley Estrom. I'm an associate professor at the School of Nursing at UNC Wilmington.
Hi, Haley. How are you doing despite all of our technical difficulties in trying to get this podcast recorded today?
You know, I think despite it all, I'm doing fairly well, Jacqueline. How are you?
I'm doing well too. I always like to start a podcast like this in a way because it just like, I don't know, makes it more fun sometimes.
We can only go up, right?
We can really only go up from here. At least we're recording.
Yep, we're here. We've got the Wi-Fi. It's working. And I'm so excited that we're going to get to talk with Dr. Caitlin Proctor today. She is someone that I've gotten to collaborate with on some projects over the last, since right before COVID, really. And yeah. I know, right? And so we're going to get to continue our series of our previews to the 2025 Psychological Summit today. That will be held on August 22nd. And Caitlin is going to be talking to us a little bit about her talk that's titled Food Allergy and ARFID, an Underrecognized Clinical Complication and Conceptual Framework. Kate is an assistant professor at Emory School of Medicine, and she's a clinical psychologist at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. And Kate, to start us off, could you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into taking care of pediatric patients that have both food allergy and feeding issues?
Yes, happy to. Thank you for the welcome. I'm so excited to be with you all today. I think like many people who wind up in the feeding space, my route here was a bit circuitous. I'm glad to see all of the increasing awareness and knowledge and advocacy happening around feeding concerns. And my route to this point, you know, was a little more winding. So I am a clinical child and adolescent psychologist by background, when I was in graduate school, I began specializing in pediatric psychology, which is really working from a psychological perspective and behavioral mental health perspective at the interface of child chronic illness and family coping and adaptation. And so really the role of a pediatric psychologist is to try to support the child's health and well-being within the medical system, within the larger family system, within their community, within their school settings. And so across my training and in early career, I worked in different medical populations like GI disorders, cancer and blood disorders, primary care. And I began noticing this pattern that feeding is transdiagnostic in the sense of it's such a cross-cutting issue for kids and families, both from a primary care, like, you know, front-facing, high-contact medical practice up to some of these highly specialized medical communities. And so as across my training, I worked in primary intervention modalities like cognitive behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, behavioral problem solving, parent-child interaction therapy. And so when I was transitioning in my early career, I found this feeding program at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta that had these really interesting and compelling multi-level models of care, and treated children with a wide range of medical and developmental complexity. And so that's how I became interested in working with feeding. And as I started working in our program, I began noticing, and we began developing relationships with our food allergy program with Dr. Brian Vickery, who is a very active and prolific food allergy expert. And he came to our center, and we started connecting around the shared patient population that we had. We were seeing higher than community prevalence rates of allergy in our feeding population. And so as we started talking with Brian, he's like, hey, you know, I think we might have some kids that aren't making it to you guys, but are also having some feeding challenges. And right. So we started doing some quality improvement and research efforts to try to understand and start to tease that apart and kind of start the process of getting our arms around this issue, this intersection. Because I think historically, when feeding has come up within the food allergy context, it's been, oh, this is just part and parcel for food allergy. It's just anxiety. It's unavoidable.
Kind of accept it.
Just kind of accept it. Yeah, it's just part of it. And so we started working together to really bring the disciplines to the table and start to look at this problem in a different way.
Yeah, and what is that different way to start to begin to look at it?
Yeah, so, I mean, as a first step, we have been trying to engage in some discussion within our professional contexts about legitimizing ARFID and pediatric feeding problems as something that is not just something we have to accept as part and parcel with food allergies, and then help guide or provide some framework for how providers can start to differentiate and identify when this problem is when feeding problems are occurring at a different level than would be reasonable to just attribute solely to the medical diagnosis.
Yeah.
And then also to think about, with that knowledge, what do we do with treatment? So once we've identified it, standard of care for feeding problems adequate, or based on our clinical experience, we're starting to suspect that potentially there's some adaptations that could maximize benefit for our patients.
Yeah. In your view, are those types of things part of where you see multi or interdisciplinary care heading in the next 3 to 5 years? And are there other pieces that you might see as part of that? I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but yeah. I've been working sort of in your orbit over the last few years. But I mean, what other things do you think might be going along with that type of work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at a high level, I'd love to see the field continue to move in the direction of improved recognition across the medical community of feeding concerns. It's one of the things I love most about the work that Feeding Matters is doing. You know, to me, multidisciplinary care involves establishing best practices across a spectrum of care. So when we think about early identification being targeted or precise referrals at the time that care is needed. Yeah. And I think part of the way that I hope we continue to do that is by working directly with pediatricians and primary care providers to provide advanced education on PFD and ARFID and what we do about that once we've identified it. And then the other piece that I'm excited for, that I hope to continue to see, is that as we're building out this framework for recognizing and referring for treatment for PFD and ARFID, that we are also building out tiered levels of outpatient programming. So really having a solid framework for when a single discipline outpatient intervention is appropriate, when it is sufficient, when to collaborate, and when to refer to a higher level of care. So when I think multidisciplinary care, I think multiple disciplines, different specialties at the table. I also think it means being able to match the level of need to the type and level of intervention.
How do you see those matches being made?
That's a good question. So, you know, it's interesting from the field of psychology's perspective. As a psychology trainee, I didn't have any training in normative feeding, like standard, like typical developmental progression of feeding.
There's also not much out there in general.
No, there's not.
Right. I don't think it was a blind omission. I think there's not much to train.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So, you know, that foundation of what's normal and being able to identify when are we deviating from normal or leaving kind of the banded path of normal. And I say normal in quotes, right?
Right.
Yeah. Just that kind of developmental lens. And then, you know, historically in the field of psychology, feeding treatment has been housed either within an ABA behavioral paradigm or in an eating disorder,
right?
More traditional type of milieu setting. And so as a psychologist, having the opportunity to work with multiple specialties, I think gives some framework for when. It helps me to know when to pull other levers and know what the bounds of my practice could safely be. So, you know, I think ideally for a psychologist in the community, if we have a child presenting with ARFID, we're using something like the PFD framework or looking to check to make sure that we have at least a solid understanding of the profiles or kind of buckets that these kids are presenting with across medical skill and nutritional domains so that we know how to do targeted consultation. I don't know if that answered
your question, though. That's excellent, Kate. Truly.
No, it really is, because it gets back to like what treatment works for which kid. And it's just an outstanding question, knowing we have a limited number of professionals, a growing amount of families, and matching those will help families get the care that they need faster.
Yeah. And sometimes one of the things that we've asked is this something that only we can do, or is this something that we can connect to a family to a different resource? So trying to be kind of a good shepherd of recognizing that there are limited resources. Are we, are we practicing within our scope and treating what makes sense based on our unique provider or team's expertise? And are we leveraging our other community resources,
right,
to really tailor that care? Because PFD can and ARFID are so heterogeneous in their clinical presentation. I think that's one of the things that's the most interesting and compelling about feeding problems to me, but it is also, I think, one of the things that makes it challenging for folks who don't have a lot of background. When you're looking, you could be looking at two kids with ARFID who look completely different.
Tell us why you chose the topic of your Psych Summit presentation and why you're passionate about this topic.
Yeah, so I think in the context of food allergy, I get really excited talking about ARFID because it's something that is treatable. Unfortunately, with food allergies right now, there's no cure, and or the treatments that are available aren't appropriate for every child or have a significant potential risk profile. It winds up that the available treatments may not be the right fit for a number of reasons. And so in many cases, we know that we can provide feeding-based intervention that works. And so if we can identify kids who may be suffering from ARFET as a complication of their allergy, I think that represents an opportunity to ensure that families are well supported and receiving optimal care. So I think for me, that's why I get so excited about this topic, is because I've seen firsthand as a clinician the difference that having more freedom as it relates to food and eating can provide without changing the allergy. The allergy is there, unfortunately. And so how can we empower kids and families to live optimally, live and be able to navigate all of their environments, their social, their school, their healthcare environments with more freedom?
Yeah.
Food allergies are hard enough, and you can't take the food out of food allergies. So no. If there's something that is introducing struggle and it's something that we can help with, I think that is something that makes me passionate about this topic, because I do think we can help. I think it's just making sure that we're getting in front of the right medical providers to help, again, with identification. I know I keep talking about identification a lot, but I've had so many families come and say, I expressed these concerns before and maybe I didn't know how to express them in a way that my provider was able to hear, or we were just never asked about it, or like we just assumed it was part.
Well, I was going to say, condition. Like, if it's assumed to be part of food allergies, then yeah you're not going to highlight it as something that you need additional support for.
Here's a part where they're maybe taking it's changing which jobs they accept, or it's changing where they live, or it's really impacting their lifestyles, or they're restricting foods unnecessarily.
Well, that's a great reason to be passionate about the topic. And so one of the other things that we've been thinking a lot about in these sessions is basically with the opportunity to have so many different disciplines coming together to look across the lifespan and break silos down. What do you think is something that you're looking forward to, or one idea that might flip the way some people think about your topic, and even maybe it's one discipline thinking about it a certain way and flipping that on its head?
So psychologists and physicians in allergy think about avoidance very differently. And it's interesting because there are aspects to managing food allergy that require this kind of avoidance. But how do we keep it in its right place, right? It makes adaptive sense, and it is important as part of food allergy management to avoid your allergens. Our bodies help us to avoid our allergens by giving us signals when we are contacting foods we are allergic to. And that paradigm, that body signaling and that learning paradigm are so helpful to us, but they can also, I think there's a double-edged sword there, in the sense that we have this upregulation in our bodies related to allergen ingestion that can also translate and become overgeneralized and expanded out to create those big physiological signals in absence of ingesting the allergen. So, if we are being vigilant and attentive to our environment, we're always scanning, we're always hyper-attuned to make sure, because we're required to be these ways, to make sure we're not encountering our allergens, that creates an environment of attention to both the outside, and then for young kids, also they're learning over time. They have to be really attentive to their internal state, so their interoceptive cues. If I have a food allergy and I'm consuming a new food or I'm eating in a new location, my brain and body are hardwired to keep me safe by having a low threshold for detecting signs or symptoms of a reaction. But those signs and symptoms of reaction early on may be pretty similar to symptoms of anxiety or disgust. So, for example, is my chest feeling a little tight because I am having, this is an impending anaphylactic reaction, or is my chest a little tight because I am nervous and I'm breathing more in my chest than in my diaphragm? That is a hard distinction for most adults to make reliably. And now if we imagine we're 3 or 5 or 8 and our parents are asking us, how are you feeling? What's going on? Why are you feeling that way? Oof, like that's a tough line to walk. Yeah. And so I think I'm really interested in understanding or bringing one of the things that I think we talk a lot about in intervention context is how can we differentiate what our body is when our body's trying to help keep us safe and when we're maybe firing some signals that are cueing us to something else. And then what do we do about that? So we have an allergy management plan. Do we have an anxiety management plan? Do we have a disgust management plan? In my talk, we'll dig in a little bit to how do we develop some skills for being able to have a shared vocabulary between kids and their parents? How do we help individuals to feel more confident in making that discernment themselves as well?
So when looking at the other sessions, which we do have, I mean, there's so many fantastic ones. And I know some other people have mentioned that they're looking forward to yours. But among the others, are there any that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. I will struggle to answer this question, but I think going back to, I think it's really compelling to think about developmentally normative feeding progression, mm-hmm. particularly in the context of food allergies. So I'm very excited about the infant and young child toddler talks.
Yeah.
As it relates to food allergy, I think this is a compelling thing to understand because over the last 10 years, guidance for allergen introduction has changed so significantly. Moving from, 10 years ago, the advice was to wait until past a year to introduce any allergens. And now it's introduce it between 4 to 6 months if the child is, particularly if the child's at risk for developing allergies. So I think, I'm really interested to hear more about this kind of early progression of feeding and thinking about, as it relates to allergen exposure, how those experiences might translate to early feeding patterns. While I think we want to advance identification and treatment for ARFID in the context of food allergy, it would be pie in the sky, big goals to hear about how we can take a more proactive or preventative approach if we can identify risk factors for developing these problems long-term based on a child's allergy characteristics or experiences.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, Kate. And also, so one of the questions that we ask everyone on our podcast is, what are the barriers that you see to having families be part of research and making it truly family-centered? And what are some things you think that we could do about overcoming those barriers?
The first answer that comes to mind is this tension that I think academic health researchers walk between timelines and grant submissions and deadlines mm-hmm. and deliverables. And so I think that often creates some external and artificial pressures around generating products and productivity. And I think that can stifle mm-hmm. some of the relationship building and opportunities to connect and really take a family-partnered, family-centered approach truly. And so I'm really excited. I've really loved getting to hear about, experience, see how you all are approaching in Feeding Matters, some of the family-centered research, because I think being able to have infrastructure in place that allows families to join alongside, to partner with, researchers to partner with, and already have that infrastructure of the type that Feeding Matters is establishing goes a long way and is extremely helpful. Because I think like it provides a really nice synergy of we're all oriented towards the same end goal, and that is improving care for families, for our patients. And so I think continuing to build out that infrastructure is a really exciting and important next step.
Oh, thank you, Kate. We've asked this question a lot, and I don't think we've ever thought about the consortium being I think we have thought about the consortium being a solution to it in its ideal, but that it's tangibly working in that way is just really great to hear, especially from an external perspective, because that's what we hope is happening, and just love to hear that. So thank you even for sharing that with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So, Kate, thank you for joining us. And we are really looking forward to your session at the Psych Summit coming up. If you're out there interested in this topic and you'd like to come listen to Kate, please join us on August 22nd for the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit. It's also available on demand. So thanks, Kate. Thanks, Haley. I hope you all have a great day, and we'll see everybody next week. Bye.
Thank you.